You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. Watch highlights from this and other Office Hours interviews on YouTube at youtube.com/Belfer Center. I chatted with Avril Haines, who served as the Deputy Director of the CIA from 2013 to 2015, and later as Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama from 2015 to 2017. You did something unusual after college. You started an independent bookstore at what was previously a bar that was auctioned off by the feds, and it had a brothel upstairs or something?
It didn't end up getting auctioned off, as it turns out, but you're right. It was a drug seizure, basically, and they ended up putting it on the market in an unusual way, but yeah.
It seems, I mean, and starting this independent bookstore is basically like the hipster dream, but then 15 years later, you were the number two at the CIA, living, your James Bond dream, a sort of M of some sort, of the United States CIA. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm not really sure I can give you a good answer to that. When I was in the bookstore, I thought I could do it. This is really a humiliating story, but I'll nevertheless. I thought I could do it at the same time that I was doing graduate school in physics. And I just thought, I can open up a bookstore. I'll be able to study
so
while
easy.
I'm at the front desk.
No,
great. It's going to be great, And my husband and I, he was my boyfriend at the time, we loved the idea of having a bookstore cafe, and we were living in Baltimore in Fells Point, and we thought, well, let's try it. And there wasn't one, it seemed like the right atmosphere for it. And so we did it, and I ended up quickly realizing that I needed to take a leave from essentially school and do the bookstore. I was working at the time at Johns Hopkins with the head of the physics department. And then I found myself getting interested in community service. And, I started with the Homeowners Association, then I was at the Business Association and working with the community on a variety of things. And I really enjoyed it. And I realized that I was more passionate about that than I was about the bookstore cafe, and not because I wasn't passionate about books, I am, but what I quickly realized in running a bookstore cafe is that it's still a business, and you sort of end up working for the bottom line and trying to make sure you're survivable. And so I thought, well, I remember going away for a weekend by myself and thinking, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? What is this? Do I want to open more stores? Do I want to do this? And the bank had sort of come back to us and said, you're doing well enough. You could start to do more Adrian's Book Cafes. And I decided I didn't. I didn't want to be a business person. That wasn't what I was interested in. I wanted to try something with the community. And when I was doing community work, I found that the people who really understood the most about how to change society, how to work the system, how to improve things, were lawyers for the most part. So I thought, well, let me go to law school and see what that's like.
To learn how to change the system.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of come back to, I went with the thought that I would come back to community work in many respects. And then when I was at law school, it was a very interesting experience and I really enjoyed it. But I remember, in one of those moments where you're in a classroom and somebody comes to talk and says, here are the interesting things you might do. It's still my first year, right? And I was thinking, I'm not really sure how I'm going to translate this. I don't really know what this means yet. And this woman said, well, one of the most interesting things to do is to intern at the State Department. And, if you decide to do that, I think you'll find it to be very rewarding. And another thing you should do is take a summer and work for a professor that you really like. So I decided to do both of those things. And I just found that I loved international law. I just, I went to the State
Couldn't
Department.
Couldn't get enough of those treaties.
It's totally true.
Is that right?
It is totally true. Yeah. I get teased mercilessly for this, by the way.
International conventions are just
They are fascinating.
So good.
Don't joke. I am totally serious, deadly serious about treaties. But I really enjoyed it. And it was a whole other world to me. And so that sort of, then one thing led to another. It's a lot of chance.
Let's talk about your time at the CIA. So, eventually you moved between State Department, White House, and then CIA, and then back to the White House. But the CIA, you were the first woman to hold the position of Deputy Director.
Yeah.
And historically speaking, men have occupied leadership positions in the CIA. Why do you think that is? Is that because men like to keep secrets more than women do? think
yeah,
that's...
I think categorically not that. That would not be my reason.
Not be the reason.
I know, but it's nice that you think that.
Okay.
I don't like,
it's possible.
Maybe it's because women are so much better at keeping them than
that
you realize.
They don't need to,
exactly.
Need to be in an institution about intelligence.
You know, I think the historical reasons are, you know, in some respects self-evident, which is to say that it was very much a majority male institution for a very long time, and over time you've seen women become more and more prominent and more numerous throughout the agency, and yet there are still issues. And former Secretary Albright did a study essentially on female diversity at the agency that's well worth reading, and it gives a little bit of the history of women at the agency and some of the challenges that they faced. But it was a fascinating experience. I mean, being the first female deputy director, I think I had focused more on the fact that I was not a career CIA person coming into that position, and that was unusual for the deputy position. Typically, the director was not somebody who had grown up in the CIA, and the deputy was somebody who had. And typically, the deputy's position was one where you sort of run operations and you do a lot of management stuff and deal with the budget, deal with a variety of things that are kind of institutional issues. And I was really concerned when John and President and others talked to me about the job, and just that I was not going to be the right person.
Because you were an outsider.
I was a lawyer.
So it was harder as an outsider. You think it was harder as an outsider than as a woman in that position?
Well, it was at least the first thing that was on my mind when I started the position. And among the things that I found interesting was the sort of, I wasn't expecting, but I should have been, some of the reactions of women at the agency to my being there. And I remember one of the first tours that I went on. I went to the farm. I went to a couple of places that are typical. And this one woman came up to me. She was in her, I'd say, probably late 50s, somewhere in there. And she just burst into tears and just gave me a hug and said, I've waited so long to see a woman come into the leadership position. You know, you don't even realize how much just your being there sometimes can have an impact on those types of things. It was, but there were so many extraordinary women at the agency, and I had this just incredible opportunity to have a chance to meet many of them. And there were already a number of women in leadership positions when I came into the deputy position. I mean, the third in command, we call her the Exter, is a woman.
The Exter?
Yeah, I know. It's sort of the executive director, basically.
Oh,
and
Exter.
So she does,
Are you the Depter? Were you the Depter?
Depter, no. DDCIA, okay. Believe
D-D-C-I-A.
It or not. Yeah, that was how I,
okay.
Yes. Or
they don't have
there's
not like a one, because in the State Department, the undersecretary
is P. Exactly.
And then the deputy is D.
Yeah, exactly.
And the CIA doesn't have a...
DDCIA. That's how you refer
I want,
to.
I want Q, like, I want M, I want a double... Do you have the license to kill, by the way?
No, I do not.
Because that would be very cool. What is the relationship between, as an outsider coming into the CIA with White House experience and then going back to the White House, that is a rare combination and cycle of careers.
Yeah.
What is the relationship between the White House and the CIA? Does the CIA have autonomy in the sense that, does the CIA's workflow depend on the policy of the president? Or does it have a sense of, we're going to focus on what our priorities are?
So there's a complicated answer to that, just because it's certainly true that the CIA's work is dependent on the president's decisions and policy, right? So in other words, we will be focusing on things or doing things at his direction or her direction if we ever have a female president. And we are providing analysis on issues that the White House and the other agencies and departments are asking us for. But at the same time, there is a kind of an independence, and maybe this is what you're alluding to in a sense. One of the things that I remember John talking to me about, Brennan, before I came in, was that value that he saw me offering, I'm not really sure it bears out, was that as a lawyer, I had spent a lot of time thinking about my institutional role in meetings, right? So I'm supposed to be there to provide legal advice. I'm not there as a policy person. That's not my role. And yet there is a lot of gray space between these two things, right? And because there are not always clear legal answers, and people wonder whether the lawyer is giving them all of the information that they have in order to allow them to take the policy decision, or whether they're, you know, coloring things in some respects, risk or otherwise, as a result. But it's something that you have to establish credibility on the fact that you are there to provide the legal advice. That's your role in the room, and you're not there to take the policy decisions. Similarly, with the Central Intelligence Agency, you're providing frequently the intelligence analysis. You're not there as a policymaker. You're an intelligence officer. And the idea is that there should be a kind of a hands, you know, an arm's length relationship, in a sense, between the policymakers and the intelligence that's being provided, whereby you say, look, these are, this is what we see, this is our analytic view on something. It may be inconsistent with what a policymaker's perspective is on a particular issue, but there's value in having folks who are actually don't have a dog in the fight for the policy issue, right? They're not, they don't feel as if the policy is something that their own institution is enacting, and as a consequence, they're not concerned about, or their component isn't concerned with, essentially grading the homework is somehow, sometimes the way it's put or done, with respect to how the policy is being implemented or affected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So, it's a very complex relationship. I mean, there's a sense of, yes, you know, you should do your thing, but at the same time, I'm also telling you what you should be
doing. I'm going to tell you what I think, and it's not going to be colored by right some policy.
Partisan politics.
Right. And generally, the fact that, like, you may have been trying to work very hard to stabilize a particular region, and frankly, from an analytic perspective, we don't see any impact to that, for example, that kind of thing.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Why do we know so little about North Korea? I mean, how does a state like that exist? We have the world's best intelligence agencies. We have, you know, I think something like 50% of the satellites are launched by the U.S., or at least a huge proportion of them. In today's day and age, in 2017, how could a state exist like that we don't know anything about, or we know very little about?
Yeah, we know something about, but you're absolutely right. So in the intelligence business, you call North Korea a hard target.
Hard target?
Hard target.
It's a very hard target.
It's a very hard target. And it's interesting because it's some... You find a lot of comparisons made between Iran and North Korea, right? And because, you know, look, these are two countries that we focused on from a non-proliferation standpoint. And we had an interest in knowing as much as we possibly could about their, you know, their programs, their intentions, whether or not they're weapon, all of these different things. And the reality is Iran was much easier from two perspectives. One is that it was an easier intelligence target than North Korea. It still is hard. It's not to diminish the challenge, you know, that you're facing when you're trying to get the right intelligence, and particularly of things that they obviously don't want you to get intelligence on. But also, it was easier to isolate and to put pressure on effectively, because, frankly, they're more interconnected to the world market, right? So you just have an easier time of actually putting the kind of economic pressure that sanctions can do on Iran. And I'd say the reason that it's so tough with North Korea is they're not as interconnected, right? So you don't have as many people traveling.
It's
and
much more of a closed system.
Very much so.
Much more closed. And the borders are much strict. I mean, smaller borders. It's a smaller place, too. Yeah. I imagine it's easier to hold a smaller population.
I don't know. It's not... It has less to do with the size or, you know, that type of thing, and more to do with the fact that you really don't have as many vectors in, basically, whether it's from human or SIGINT or other types
of
intelligence.
Like cyber connectedness. I mean, you're talking about all sorts of realms.
And then you don't have as many of the individual citizens of the country, right, like capable of communicating.
Yeah, traveling,
as we do,
or et cetera, with Iran.
Exactly, yeah. And it's a fascinating place in many respects, but it's and very tragic. And considering what an enormous national security challenge it is, it's one that we need as much intelligence as possible.
So what are the ways that we've learned more about it? Do we rely more on human intelligence? Do we rely more on, is that something that we even collaborate with states in the region and their human intelligence, or the Chinese, for instance, because they don't seem to be They seem to be sometimes, there's always these rifts that kind of develop between the two because they don't always be are doing stuff that the Chinese want them to be doing. And so the Chinese feel like they don't have the influence. I mean, how do we gather more information?
Yeah, very hard to talk about in an unclassified way, to be honest. It's not something that I could really get into. But it's what I would say is that you almost always, against hard targets, need as many partners as possible. I mean, you're basically interested in trying to accumulate information in every possible way. And it's also, it's certainly true that China, the relationship between China and North Korea is a fascinating one in which, you know, there's, typically when you get into North Korea policy and you start to look at the issue, you consistently focus on the China-North Korea relationship because so much of their trade is with China. Right. China has the capability to put pressure on them in a way that nobody else does because of the way the systems work. China also is, sees, an unstable North Korea as almost an existential threat, in a sense, given, you know, the flow of refugees or the concern of the conflict right on the border, all of those things you can imagine that would be there. So they have this absolute interest, I think, in seeing a denuclearized Korean peninsula, one, you know, an objective that we share in many respects. But at the same time, pursuing that dream, I think they are consistently less willing to take risks than we are, given what they've got sitting on their border. So, yeah.
It's a complicated situation.
Yeah.
Did you spend a lot of time in the Situation Room?
Yes.
Did you?
God, yeah.
What's it like in there? It seems like such an intense place, high intensity, very mysterious. You know, were the only beverages available things like Red Bull and 5-Hour Energy?
No, it's, you know, it's not nearly as sexy as you think it's going to be in some respects.
I mean, it feels sexy.
Right?
It's like this, got this in the pictures with the Osama bin Laden raid.
We went, I think, to another, I think it was at SOCOM. I remember the president walking in and seeing their kind of version of the Situation Room and going, how come we don't have this?
Like, it was way nicer?
It was
bigger?
Way nicer. Where, much more like the movies show the sit room. The sit room is a remarkable place in the sense that you know the history surrounding it and you feel that sometimes. But it really is just a windowless room where, you know, you've got a really big conference table and a screen that allows you to have people civets in from around the world, which is pretty amazing. And it's not unlike other conference rooms that, you know, really most corporations have nowadays. But it has a tremendous number of White House Situation staff and personnel that run it who are extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And they love the history of the place, and they are, you know, nobody's better at their job than they are at trying to set up communications when we've got an issue, you know, a crisis occurs, like, you know, a coup in Turkey or something like that, right? And basically, we run off to try to get as many, you know, can we get the ambassador on the screen? Can we get the commander for the region on the screen? All of those people right away.
So you can't just book it for any sort of reason, like, it's got to be
a crisis.
It has to be, not as a private citizen, but if you're, how does it work?
So as the Deputy National Security Advisor, you know, I could just basically whenever deputies were there. I always obviously got outranked by the National Security Advisor and the president.
But, if they wanted it.
If they wanted it, they get it.
And you got to go to some other conference.
There's three rooms in the sit room. So you can use another conference room if you need to. And then there's actually other conference facilities that are available for it. So, yeah.
Everyone, I'd love to keep on talking, but sadly I think we're out of time. But thank you so much for joining
us
today.
You.
This is really, really great.
Terrific.
Thank
Anytime.
You. Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.